KEPWLP 96.
The show is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SSD, here on KEPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kpw.org. All right, I got a special edition for you today. I got an interview with a solar panel co-op. You know, I stopped saying, I used to say rooftop solar on every show because we need rooftop solar. We don't need solar power plants that you pay for a line to run to your house. But the object is to get off of fossil fuels. So this solar co-op, we're going to try to explain it to you. It takes investors. You can invest and get a return on your money, and you never pay off the solar panels, but you pay a monthly fee lower than what you would pay to the utility company, and that pays for other solar roofs. So, and pays back a little bit to the investors, the initial investors. So I've got Grayson Flood from People Power Solar of California. And I just found there's a co-op here in Oregon, too. So I'm in contact with them, and hopefully I'll get them on for an interview. And we're going to get these solar panels, solar roofs rolling and get off fossil fuels here in the 21st century. There's no reason to be using fossil fuels anymore. All right, so that's coming up. Grayson Flood from People Power Solar of California. You can't invest in California, but you can invest. You can look for your solar co-op here in Oregon and invest in that. And I'm going to ask him about why we don't have solar parking lots, solar-covered parking lots at grocery stores. It has to do with leasing the land. The grocery store don't own their own land. So that's why they don't. That's the only reason they don't put solar panels on grocery stores. We have plenty of surface area of roofs to put solar panels on. Don't need to have solar farms that take up habitat. All right. So coming up here on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kpw.org. Grayson Flood of People Power Solar. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. If you support us this month, we'll call out to your pet. We'll do a call out to your pet. If you donate in honor of your pet, we'll get extra money for that. And you will get your pet's name announced on the local community radio station. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
Hello?
All right. Hey, Grayson, you there?
Yeah, Curtis.
Yeah, can you hear me? Okay. Okay, so I'm with Grayson Flood of People Power Solar, a solar co-op in California. So, Grayson, tell me about People Power Solar.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So People Power Solar Cooperative is a member-owned cooperative in Oakland, California that was founded 2 years ago, but we're open to membership to anyone in California. And I think the heart of the problem that we're trying to solve, if we zoom back to the sort of history of energy ownership since we migrated off of just using basically solar energy at the heart of everything we did, agriculture, into industry where we started tapping into fossil fuels, we've seen sort of through the arc of industrialization in the West, a monopolization over energy ownership because of how energy comes from the ground, whether it's coal or oil. We've also seen that the control of energy flows are crucial to achieving democratic power. So we've seen that, for example, coal workers 200 years ago, their strikes were some of the most crucial strikes in winning us things like the weekend. We fast forward to today, and we see that our use or overuse of fossil fuels is leading to a global crisis, environmental crisis. We also see that the monopolization of things around the monopolization of fossil fuel resources like oil has led to, among other things, incredible economic inequality. And so the problem becomes, as we transition to green energy, I think it's twofold. One, is there a way to do this, given that renewable energy is so much more easily distributed in a way that provides more equity, particularly to working class communities, communities of color, frontline communities? And is there a way to do this transition at all without centering those communities in our way forward? And so People Power Solar Cooperative, our goal is to create this just and inclusive transition by centering frontline communities, working class communities, and communities of color, and finding pathways to the control and ownership of energy right now in the state of California in tandem with cooperatives around the country and around the world, as well as with unions and environmental justice groups that are allies in our fight.
Well, and so Oakland especially is in need of Oakland is a high people of color demographic, mm-hmm. in Oakland, and there isn't much funding available in Oakland. So that's what I'm getting at, though, too, is what I wanted to start with is why isn't there any funding, especially in Oakland? I guess it's based on the tax base, for one thing. So there's a lower tax base in Oakland, California, because it's not a wealthy area comparatively. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean. Why is there no government funding for solar panels still to this day?
I think it comes down to the fact that in the energy industry, as well as, you know, if you look at utilities, which are natural monopolies, as well as fossil fuel companies, which are, one could argue, natural monopolies by virtue of, you know, the resources coming from single parts of the ground, the profit motive for these companies historically has ruled out any sort of push for equity. And what we see now in a state like California is that the Public Utilities Commission, which supposedly should be regulating utilities to provide these opportunities to working class communities to go solar, they don't exist because by and large, utility commissions, and this is true for many states, I'm not so familiar with Oregon, but I would guess that this is true in Oregon as well, is so friendly to these for-profit utilities.
Well, because that's where they get their funding. They're basically, mm-hmm. It's a revolving door situation.
Yeah.
Is that true? Am I?
Yeah, I think it's very true.
Without
I don't have much experience working at the utility commission level,
right.
So I don't want to like speak untruths, but I do know that you see, it's, you know, it's, let's just put it this way. There's been several very valorous attempts towards creating viable community solar policy in the state of California, and it has time and time again been distorted or defeated by the utilities. And without a popular movement of people that understand energy beyond just the commodity, the dollar bills on their utility bill, but as sort of like, you know, the means of production, without a movement pushing for that type of community control of energy, you're not going to see the Public Utilities Commission start to push back on the utilities. And and we are at a point, PG&E is a very infamous utility, so I'm not ruling that out altogether, and that's indeed sort of, you know, the movement that we're a part of, but that has sort of been the history.
Well, and I took some energy audit courses down in California when I was living down there, and the jobs available to me were or the projects that the money was going to. I mean, I could get a job installing, you know, literally on a roof, but I'm getting a little too old for that. But most of the money I noticed went to solar farms. They wanted to put a solar farm out in 29 Palms, you know, where the desert tortoise, it would impact the desert tortoise habitat. When there's plenty of room, there's... I own a piece of property in 29 Palms, and the city itself is decaying, where they could, and they're tearing down homes where they could be putting solar panels on the roofs of these houses, and instead they wanted to put a solar farm and then charge people for the wire, run a wire to your house from the farm out in the middle of the desert, and then charge you for that power. Whereas you would be doing the same thing, your co-op, the person that has the solar panels put on their roof, they would be paying you, but they would be paying for additional solar roofs. So anything, go on.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about our model. I think what you're describing is, you know, I think it's important to recognize first that, you know, different geographies require different energy needs. And this comes down, again, I mean, I think back to the root issue of needing community control and decision-making around energy. Because communities can decide better than anyone, you know, where they want their energy to be sited and what their energy needs are. So I think that's a core thing. Because I think, for example, I'm calling from New York City right now. I know that if every roof in New York City were to go solar, we would only meet, I think it's around like 7 to 9% of the city's energy needs. So there are certain areas where rooftop solar is not enough. That said, in rural areas, I think the situation is quite different with places with less dense housing. So I can talk about how our model works. So we're an energy cooperative, and when you think of the word cooperative, there are a few common types of cooperatives you might think of, like consumer-owned cooperatives. REI is a popular example of that, where the patrons are also member owners and they receive dividends for their patronage of the cooperative. Then there's worker-owned cooperatives where the staff are the members and sort of governing body of the cooperative. And there's a variety of other types too, but we can stop with those two for now. One of the crucial things that's different about a cooperative, of course, is that instead of making a profit, you make a surplus. And that surplus is redistributed amongst its members through the form of dividends. And so what makes us a little bit interesting and different is that we are subscriber-owned. So if we build a project, a lot of our projects to date have looked a lot like, from a surface level, you could compare it to something like Tesla might do, like one of their lease deals where... they might come to your house, assuming you own your house, and offer to put a solar project on your roof, sign a 25-year deal, because 25 years is about how long a solar panel lasts before it deteriorates, to sell you energy at a certain rate per kilowatt hour that would save you money and then also makes them a profit.
Right. They would maintain the solar panels, and in at the end of 25 years, they would put more – they would then redo the solar roof, but you'd be paying monthly, in other words, for all this. It's a lease, so
yeah,
you're paying
like
monthly.
A utility bill.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's less than your utility bill, and you're not using fossil fuels. So go on, I'm sorry.
No worries. Yeah, that's a good clarification. So What makes us a little bit different is that, so for one, yeah, the profit isn't being, you know, piped upwards to our investors, but also that we are a subscriber-owned cooperative. We are also a worker-owned cooperative. We're also an investor-owned cooperative, and so we crowd finance, at least all of our projects to date have been crowd financed locally. It's important to us that for the money that goes into the project to come from local sources, instead of, you know, like a broad crowdfunding model. And we also have a fourth role of ownership. So we have sort of four classes of ownership within the cooperative, and I've gone over three. We have our subscriber ownership. They're the patrons of the cooperative who pay for energy. There's investor ownership. People can purchase $100 to $1,000 worth in shares. Our shares are worth $100 a piece in the cooperative to finance these projects. And we only accept shares when we know we have a project. So we don't, you know, we're not open to, it's not a pyramid scheme. You can't just like pour money into the cooperative at any time. And then the worker owners. But then the fourth ownership role, and I think this is really crucial when we think about where we're operating from and how we're trying to center frontline communities and working class communities, and recognizing that so many of these frontline communities, working class communities, communities of color, are living, you know, paycheck to paycheck, is this role of anchor ownership within the cooperative. And so we have a separate ownership class within the cooperative reserved for community members who lead and steward projects, and sort of through their sweat equity in the cooperative achieve a leadership role. And I think that ownership class, that's the sort of, our whole cooperative is kind of built around enabling these anchor owners who anchor these projects and steward these projects to be sort of the focal point of what we do. Because we recognize that if we, you know, if we're just following capital, trying to create a community, you know, a community controlled energy, but without challenging sort of, you know, the place where we are now, and not working to actually lift up the leadership of communities that have been disenfranchised, then we're going to end up falling into a lot of the same holes and a lot of the same race to the bottom that we've seen in other countries. Like, I think Europe is an example where you've seen community energy kind of go awry, because a lot of, I think, the cooperatives there weren't necessarily seeing themselves as part of a movement. And I say this, you know, not being very familiar with a lot of...
so give me an example of...
European cooperatives.
Give me an example of an anchor member.
Yeah.
Is that a person with a house that you've put solar panels on?
Yeah, so it could be. So we have, right now we have a member of our cooperative who does own a home and is interested in stewarding a project, and they want to not only go solar for their home, but they also want to install an electric vehicle charger to their garage and start a car share with their broader community, but they're within a two block radius. And so they're organizing, they're not only going solar, which would be the subscriber ownership role, they're also organizing their neighbors around this shared resource that is localized. And so that would be one example of an anchor ownership role. And it doesn't have to be solar specific. So we have another project right now that's happening that has a variety of anchor owners that have popped up. I think we've discussed of how PG&E is handling. Go ahead.
So they're compensated. They're compensated from by the co-op for their work, for their for doing that. Is that correct?
No. So it would differ from staff, because they're not. These anchor owners typically are acting for the benefit of their community and not the benefit of the cooperative at large.
Okay.
And so not all the projects are even revenue generating.
Well, but still,
the
anchor
owners might steward.
It improves their neighborhood, if nothing else. It improves their own property values. So, and it's just good neighborly stuff. So, okay, so go on. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh. No, yeah. And I can just give another example of another project that isn't revenue generating, which is this, we call it the community backup power supply. But it's basically, you can think of it as a people-powered grid. So in the Bay Area, PG&E goes through with these planned safety power shutoffs is what they call them, but they'll shut off subsections of the grid when it's gusty out in anticipation of potential wildfire. And these happen without notice. and they can last days on end. And yeah, I think they're pretty infamous. And
yeah, we've heard them in the news. We've heard about this in the news.
Yeah, and so a group of our members have started to basically organize around taking just basic lead acid batteries, and we have a few member owners that have worked in the energy industry, and they know how to convert these in a safe way into a battery pack in a milk crate on wheels that can power something like a refrigerator for 6 hours, and formed a mutual aid network within the cooperative that will enable certain homes to charge these batteries, and then when other people in the cooperative lose power in the event of these shutoffs, the batteries can be, you know, moved across town to power refrigerator, ventilator, whatever it is. And that's not a revenue generating project, but the people that are organizing this work are still anchor owners within the cooperative. And it's, I think it plays into, like, you know, our goal is not to just decarbonize. Our goal is to create a political and economic understanding of energy, and then through that build political and economic power for the communities, that frontline communities and communities of color that have been so marginalized by our transition to date.
All right, but so, I am interested, yeah, at the risk of sounding like a capitalist, I am interested, though, in what, how is it, because you do need people to invest in the co-op, so, and you pay a dividend, so how does that dividend work? How does that work?
Absolutely.
How is that determined? And, you know, what, can you give me an example of what type of dividend you're offering?
Yeah. So we have, with the first model that I talked about, where you would go solar, similar to like a lease contract with Tesla, where a homeowner goes solar, or a business goes solar and
pays a monthly fee,
dollar per kilowatt hour rate for energy. Yeah. We model those deals. So those projects to date have been entirely community financed. So through membership shares, and we have been able, we haven't claimed the tax credit for our current projects. We're certainly looking to do that because it is, although it has its flaws, is such a crucial incentive. The 20%, I think it's 20% now, federal tax credit.
Yeah, but it's very difficult. It's, the funding's just not there. But yeah, so go on. I've looked into the Desire. If you go to the Desire website, it's just a complete nightmare of trying to get
and
a refund.
And there's so many things that can be said about that.
Yeah.
That credit. But yeah, our current projects, we aim to pay a 3% dividend annually, compounding back to our investors, while also offering the property owner 10 to 20% savings on their energy bill. So it's not quite what you might see if you, you know, wanted to sign a deal with Tesla. If you're a homeowner, they might give you 20 to 30. We're going to give you 10 to 20%. But that extra, the difference in that margin goes to paying that 3% compounding dividend back to community investors. And we chose the 3% number at the outset. Of course, we would love for it to be higher. We would love to be able to just sell power directly to, you know, to build distributed projects that can sell power directly to the whole community. Fortunately, we can't do that. So we chose the 3% dividend because it's...
Right, because that's another area that you need...
More competitive than a money market account.
Because that's another area that you need to jump through tons of hoops to become a net metering and sell power back to the power company. That becomes... That's another... they make it very difficult to do that. You may not remember this, but in the 70s, they had this thing called a golden switch, you know, that the power company would make you pay like $10,000 for... because they were worried that you were going to overload... They claimed that you might overload the grid. So they wanted to put a golden switch between you and the power company. And so they have a history of making it difficult to sell power back to the power company. So, but you might do that at some point if you can get the get through the paperwork, get through the hoops. Well, I mean, why isn't it – so you need to do that as a group rather than – the individual homeowner can't sell power back to the power company, even in this co-op model that you're doing?
Yeah, so our current projects, when we build solar on a homeowner's home, those are done via individual net metering. And I don't know if it would be helpful to just sort of describe what net metering is before we talk too much about it.
Yeah, there's an inverter that they sell power back to the power company. But yeah, all right, go on. So you're just those yours are just battery based systems then, you're saying, rather than inverter based.
No, so they are inverter based. We haven't done any storage projects yet or battery projects yet, and they do operate under single off-taker net metering laws. So, like, let's say you are a homeowner in the cooperative. And we build a solar project on your roof that produces 10,000 kilowatt hours of energy a year, but you only use 9,000 kilowatt hours of that. That extra 1,000 kilowatt hours, that would get put into the grid. And at least if you're in the Bay Area, then PG&E would give you a credit on your bill for that excess energy. What we can't do is we can't do what's called group net metering or virtual net metering, where we build, say, a solar project on a church and then sell the energy produced by that, by those panels to like 10 neighboring homes. So in California, you can only sell energy to the meter that's like under the roof. Mm-hmm. Otherwise we become classified as a utility, and there's a whole bunch of sort of prohibitive costs to being compliant with that.
Yeah. Well, and so you can't also, what I was wondering though, is if you could get a group of homes and call that a power company, the whole group of homes that sell, that combine all that power and sell it back. But I don't want to go in. That's a whole other story. All right. So, so that's the commons model that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And, what is the Ingleside project?
Yeah. So we've talked about the sort of different owners within the cooperative. Another sort of concept that we have that I think lines up with the principles of a cooperative, specifically the idea of autonomy and independence, is the cooperative operate as an administrative and legal backbone for a diverse array of communities around California that are all stewarding energy projects in their own way. And we do this, we like to use the metaphor of a solar system where the cooperative is a solar system and maybe the core cooperative is the sun, but all these individual projects are planets that have their own autonomy within the cooperative. And we call these groups project groups. And so Ingleside Community Power is our first project group within the cooperative, and they can kind of be thought of as their own cooperative, even though they're not like legally a separate organization. They're still under the umbrella of People Power, but they do have their own leadership committee and their own sort of version of bylaws for how they operate, along with the geographic scope that they've self-determined. And they're going to be looking to develop solar projects. There's not any yet because unfortunately the pandemic hit right as they were starting to organize, but organize commons model type projects in the Ingleside neighborhood of San Francisco. And their project group will be able to basically govern how the revenue from those projects is reinvested back in their community. And they just pay sort of a nominal administrative fee up to People Power for the administrative tasks and the technical aid that we're able to provide. So because energy has just become such a complex thing, and most people think of energy in terms of just the dollars on the utility bill, I think the primary role that the People Power core provides to these project groups is the energy education, organizing education, and the administrative services. Like, if you have a bunch of subscribers, you need technology and to be able to manage the subscriptions, to provide bills to them, et cetera. So, and this is similar to a lot of other cooperatives in the country. I just want to say, like, we've taken a lot of inspiration and are definitely standing on the shoulders of cooperatives like Co-op Power in Massachusetts and New York, and Cooperative Energy Futures in Minnesota. Both operate with this similar model of smaller, localized cooperatives within a broader organization.
And I'm sorry, I got to go back for a second, too. The original way that I found you was through the Sustainability's Law Center, Sustainable Communities Law Center. And so you can actually put your IRA, you can invest in California only if you're a resident of California. You're looking at having people put their individual retirement accounts could be invested in this so that it would be they wouldn't pay taxes on the interest that they earn. So is that happening, or is that are you trying to get that going?
Yeah, that's a great question. I am unfortunately I know that that's been something that Sustainable Economies Law Center is working on. We have not integrated it with what we're doing yet, but I do know the intention is to basically create an IRA that can be invested in worker owned and
all right. Well, and so there was another project. There was another project that you wanted to talk about.
Oh yeah, yeah. Let's talk about that. I think another project that we're starting to look at, and it's going to be interesting because it's a little different from this commons model project, is a community solar project in Fresno. And so, you know, I think we recognize that just give the current policy landscape right now really privileges property owners in our renewable transition, because there is no way as a renter in California, just like I think in Oregon, with the exception of, you know, other amazing cooperatives that are working in Oregon right now, to go solar if you're a renter, if you don't own your property or if you have a shaded roof. And so we would love to not be doing these commons model projects all the time. We would love to not be, as much as we love our property owners that volunteer to go solar with us, and you know, they're a vital part of this movement towards separating the ownership of land from the ownership of power, we would love to be able to move to community-owned distributed projects at large and not just having to do deals where we sell power directly to property owners. And so we're working on a project right now in Fresno, and we're going to – it's still in a very preliminary stage, but it's part of a new community solar program in the state of California called the Community Solar Green Tariff that has been – put together by a variety of environmental justice groups that have fought to shape this community solar policy. That basically the way it works is you put in a bid to a utility to for a certain solar project to sell energy to the grid, directly to the grid, and then the utility, in this case PG&E, sells that energy to a set of subscribers in a community that's located, I want to say, but this might not be totally accurate, within 50 miles of the project. They find subscribers and they give them a 20% bill credit on their bill for subscribing to this project. And what's kind of unique about this program, I mean, this is community solar programs are pretty rare in California, especially functional ones. They're more common in other states, particularly in the Northeast. But what's also kind of peculiar about this one and really promising is that it has an equity lens. And so these projects can only exist within census tracts that rank within the top, and again, I'm not positive on my numbers here, but like I want to say like the top 10% percentile of CalEnviroScreen, which is a state ranking for basically pollution. So they can only be cited in environmental justice communities or in nearby them. And they also require a community sponsor. And this is, you know, we're sort of in the Wild West right now with these types of policies, but we're potentially, fingers crossed, and we should be finding out within the next couple of weeks, hopefully going to have an accepted bid for this project, which would allow us to move forward with building in partnership with a great community development corporation in Fresno, the El Dorado Park CDC, and Shake Energy, who's been the sort of the main developer for this project, moving forward to building a community-controlled and owned solar project that would sell power to 20 or so homes in the El Dorado Park neighborhood of Fresno if this bid is accepted. And so we're sort of at the point, and this is sort of what everything that we do is not just about, you know, building the project that shows that this business model is functional, but also building the project that builds the movement for future projects that can be even more democratically controlled and governed. And this is, if it does happen, would be, you know, a huge step forward in piloting a model for community-owned energy and controlled energy in California.
Right, that you're going to build on this. So you're just trying to get an inroad into this.
Well, exactly.
because what you're describing is a solar farm that will sell power to the power company, and then that goes to the renters of homes, because the renter can't put solar panels on a rented home. So you're mm-hmm. still, and the object is to get off of fossil fuels. Is we need to get off fossil fuels at all costs right away. So I'm with you
yeah.
on there. So
I would say that it's about, I just want to jump in and say that I think it's about getting off fossil fuels, but I think it's also about making sure we do it in a way that allows communities to
that empowers
gain
communities.
Political and economic power through that process. Because I'm not sure if we even can get off fossil fuels without doing that.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very difficult and to do. So that's why you're doing it any
yeah.
way you can. So yeah. And so I noticed solar panels have become much more efficient now,
mm-hmm.
too. They used to be only like 20 watts, and what, they're 300 watts. Where are you getting your solar panels?
Yeah, so we're not an installer, and so for our projects, we contract with third-party installers, and workforce development is a sort of a crucial factor in all of our how we move forward with any project. So we, you know, try to prioritize working with unionized installers or employee-owned installers. Try to prioritize working with installers that source their infrastructure locally, not remotely. I think there's a whole separate conversation to be had about, you know, the extractivist background that undergirds our transition in the North. That's, you know, all the resources that are having to be mined in places like Bolivia and in Australia.
Right, and I've heard of projects.
We don't pick our panels, but we those are decisions that are factored in and often made by the community, not even us, in how we move forward with these projects.
Well, and that was the other experience I had, was these guys come from somewhere else, some other state, and bring in their mm-hmm. their labor from another state on these large projects and put so you're at least keeping the labor local, and I imagine there
mm-hmm.
might be maybe there's tax incentives for that too. So
yeah.
All right, well how you guys advise people, though, your advisory role too. So how would I approach for one thing, a nonprofit? And then how would I approach an installer to do this, if I had a project?
Yeah. So I think, you know, coming to someone like us would be a great first step, because that really is our job as a, excuse the jargon, but as a thought partner for figuring out how to make this type of stuff work. And so much of what, from the financing to who the installer should be, to how the energy is used, because energy can be used for so many things, you know, beyond just, there's so many creative ways to use energy, like whether it's electric vehicle car share or just, you know, to power your existing usage. There's a lot that would vary from project to project, but it would start with a conversation with the cooperative and then also with your community about how to move forward. And we would explore sort of the benefits you're looking for from the project, the sites that you're looking at, how you would want to finance the project would be crucial, because there are options out there. You know, it's not every project needs to be entirely community financed. There are ways of writing in grants, looking at other forms of equitable investment with pathways to community ownership, and then figuring out how the community in the long term would govern, you know, not just the project, but all the revenue streams that might emerge from it.
Well, I know this isn't what you're doing, but I just am curious. I can't understand why, like, for instance, Whole Foods doesn't put a solar roof on their grocery stores and have a covered parking lot, especially in Southern California where it's so hot. Every time you go out to your car, it's scalding hot. You could have a car cover, you know, a steel car cover covered with solar panels. Or, you know, a co-op. We have several co-op grocery stores up here, Sundance. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty small store, but, you know, what... two questions. Why? What is stopping? Most grocery stores rent their property, so I guess that is what's stopping them. Is there a way to approach the land owner and get them to give a discount in rent to the or charge more in rent to the grocery store, and then the grocery store would recoup that in free and low cost energy? Because I mean, they just the refrigeration alone in a grocery store is huge.
Mm-hmm. That is such a great question. And it's one that, you know, we're, I think, grappling with constantly. And it's different whether you're looking at a, you know, a for-profit Whole Foods versus a grocery cooperative versus, you know, like a city building, like a public school. Mm-hmm. Because there might be, you know, the profit motive is going to be different for a private landlord than for someone else. But I do think, in general, the trend that we found, just speaking empirically here, is that at the end of the day, the landlord, unless you're taking all of the benefits from the project and passing them all along up to the landlord, which of course is not, you know, a very equitable way to move forward if we're trying to spread the financial benefits to renters, and then there really isn't a lot of incentive for these landlords to participate. And there are, I think, ways around this. There's ways of doing local organizing. A lot of, like, smaller landlords, you know, they're members of their community. And I think if you come at it through this sort of relational organizing angle, and trying to engage them as members of the community and not just, you know, financial participants in this deal, mm-hmm. then you can appeal to that. And we do that, you know, not just with landlords. I mean, we do that with homeowners, you know, who are, by and large, you know, Bay Area folks that are very aligned with our vision and own their home, but they still have to recognize, like, I could save more money for myself if I went with Tesla. Mm. And it's challenging that challenging capital basically is, you know, you can't do it by just appealing to the property owners alone. You need the movement as well. So, because otherwise it's just a business idea and a really bad one at that.
The idea is to perpetuate solar energy more than to get yourself a good deal on solar panels. We're trying to perpetuate the use of solar.
Yeah, and the idea of a commons, I think, is the other thing. We like love to show this slide of, like, you know, our pitch isn't decarbonizing, although that's certainly a big part of what we're trying to do is, you know, address climate crisis, but also trying to build sort of a, like, common pool resource that can be managed by the community for the long term. So our projects can't be resold by the cooperative. It's in our bylaws. They're come under permanent community control. And we talk to people about these states of mind, the market state of mind, where you might sell energy to the highest bidder, versus the charity state of mind, where, which is often like the flip side of the market state of mind, right? Where you use the money you got from all your highly profitable solar deals to give some free solar to people, versus the common state of mind, which is bringing people in and having them recognize sort of the lines of solidarity that they have. That as you know, a wealthier person in the Berkeley Hills, I can still invest $100 to $1,000 in a solar project that will go to create renewable infrastructure that's a common resource managed by the community in the flatlands of Berkeley, for example. So I think that's sort of the crux of what we're trying to get people to realize, is challenge the market state of mind or charity state of mind that they have and land in this common state of mind. And with that comes, like, recognizing that we know we all share our future in the climate crisis.
Right, so there's where it is a benefit for a wealthy person to help the people down in the flatlands
Exactly.
In the long run, it's long term gains rather than short term gains. Well, okay. So at the risk of sounding like a capitalist, and I know you're not a financial advisor, but it just occurs to me. So I looked up the co-op up here just today. There is a solar co-op in Oregon, and I'm going to try and get an interview with them. But they're investing. We talked about this before the interview that. They are doing churches and schools. So, as an investor, isn't that better that they have funding? They have automatic funding that is not going to be. The school system probably is not going to go out of business. So, as an investor, aren't I? Is my risk a little lower? And again, I know you're not a financial advisor, but is that? Do you think
I would say yes.
Putting solar panels on schools and investing in a co-op that puts solar panels on schools is a pretty good deal.
Yeah, I think, you know, community buildings, I think, are such a great place to host solar projects for so many reasons. You know, there's a reliable return. They're not going to go out of business like you shared. But then also, you know, if we're talking about community-owned solar, then there's a community under that roof. And so there's a natural way of, like, you know, bringing that energy control into a community that uses that energy every day. It's like, it's very organic. Another example that's similar to that, and it's a little bit more removed, is the idea of a solar farm, where, you know, it might not be the same subscriber base throughout the entire life of the project, but there's still like a sustained subscriber base to the project. And it's still a shared project that sort of is, you know, organically organized by our community. And that's, I think that folks in Oregon right now are probably a decade ahead in terms of organizing these types of projects. And I would be curious to hear your interview with this Oregon cooperative.
Well, we don't have PG&E to deal with that is just a behemoth of historical. We have Weyerhaeuser that we deal with up here rather than, it's the same, you know, you have this power, that power, PG&E has been a constant problem as I can remember as a kid. The PG&E has always been a constant problem, including offshore oil. There's oil in the bay there that they've been linked to pollution in the bay, I thought too, and the refinery down there is linked to PG&E. Although, yeah, I don't want to say anything libelous about PG&E, hopefully. So,
you better watch
Grayson yourself. Flood from People Power Solar, what else do you want? Is there other stuff that you want to say before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I just want to say, I think, one last thing, and it's something that I mean, personally been very fascinated by, but I think is important for anyone watching this energy cooperative movement move forward, which is that we need to see energy cooperatives as a piece of the larger puzzle. There's a lesson to be learned from what happened in Europe, where a lot of cooperatives were formed as, you know, this new form of energy business. A lot of them did that through sort of flat feed-in tariffs, where the grid would just pay them for energy that they produced, and there was a fixed agreement, and they could get a reliable income stream. Once the grid started getting enough renewable energy, these utilities shifted to a power purchase agreement model where you had to bid to sell energy, and it forced prices down. And what we saw was the collapse of a lot of energy cooperatives in Europe. And there's a great paper from Trade Unions for Energy Democracy that outlines sort of the horror stories, what can go wrong with cooperative energy if we're not careful. And I think what it points to is the role for energy cooperatives. You know, we're building the new, we're trying to show what democratic control of renewable energy can look like, but we can't do it without unions, without environmental justice groups that are fighting the bad, that are fighting the investor-owned utilities, that are fighting the fossil fuel companies, without, you know, I guess addressing the, like, core class conflict that exists at the center of this. And so when we call ourselves a movement cooperative, you know, it's like at its face, being an energy cooperative can look just like an innovative business model, but it's more than that. You know, we're a piece of the puzzle. We're trying to show what community control of energy can look like at the other side of our transition. to pilot these new models, but we need to do that hand in hand with, you know, the workers of the world.
An entire social justice movement.
Exactly.
All right, Grayson Flood of People Power Solar. It's peoplepowersolar.org. Is that?
That's exactly right.
Thanks very much for your time, and rock on with your projects, and I hope you are successful.
Thanks for having me, Curtis.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, there you have it. That was Grayson Flood of People Power Solar, changing the world. And as usual, it's a whole community approach that we need for this stuff. All right, so I've been playing stuff from Discipline Global Mobile, not pitching Discipline Global Mobile, but it's a different model of how they pay, how musicians are paid, and for one thing. But also, I've also been hearing, you know, musicians are hurting right now. So if you can go to your favorite musician's website and give them some support, buy a CD, buy some swag, whatever. I just realized King Crimson has, and Discipline Global Mobile has some incredible stuff on their website that I'm just over the moon about. So, yeah, check this out. This is from 2017, a show I missed that I wish I'd have gone to. Story of my life in Mexico. And support us. We have a program right now that if you send us some money, we will donate money to us in name of your pet. We will read your pet's name over the air, and kind of a fun way, and we get some matching funds for that. So I hope you'll look that up on our website at kepw.org. It's KEPW-LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org, where you can get information on how to get your dog's name, your pet's name, your pet cockroach's name announced over the air, and we'll get some money for doing that. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media.